My name is Scott Harris, one of the producers of Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and a former board member of the news and analysis website Toward Freedom. Toward Freedom and Between the Lines are sponsors of the panel today. Our panelists are Michael Fox, editor of NACLA Report on the Americas, Esnard Arevalo of Friends of the MST, and Nathan Schneider, an editor and reporter with WagingNonviolence.org. After the panelists each give about a 10 or so minute presentation, we'll open up the discussion for everyone, reserving about half our time for the wider conversation. Just a little background on our radio program that's sponsoring today's forum. Between the Lines Radio News Magazine is a weekly syndicated show. We are carried on about 50 stations around the country. We're produced by an all-volunteer staff. The program got its start way back during the Persian Gulf War, the first Persian Gulf War in 1991. And we try to give voice to all manner of progressive activists, academics, journalists, and people who are regularly shut out of the other media. Toward Freedom, the co-sponsor, is likewise been around a long time, longer than us, back in 1952. And they've created recently moved from print to an online magazine, and they report about the dynamic, progressive, and independent movements being born around the developing world. And they do a lot of great work. Now, Ben Dongle, who may be familiar to some of you, he runs another website called Upside Down World, which is really some of the cutting-edge reporting on what's going on around Latin America. And he's the author of The Price of Fire and Dancing with Dynamite. He had planned to be here, but he had a conflict, so he sends his regrets, and he's here in spirit. And we've done some interesting collaborations of workshops at the Social Forum in Atlanta, in Caracas, Venezuela, at the Social Forum a bunch of years ago, and other places around the area. And just a few words of introduction about our topic today. As the Cold War ended with the demise of the Soviet Union and movements on the left stagnated and faded in many places around the world, Latin America became the setting for some of the most vibrant and successful progressive organizing seen in many decades. Overcoming generations of U.S.-supported dictatorships, oligarchs, and Washington's long history of overt and covert intervention to suppress progressive labor, political groups, and new grass movements have sprouted up over these past couple of decades and allied themselves with political parties to actually take power in successive governments across the continent. And the destructive effects of Washington-backed neoliberal policies were certainly an important catalyst that contributed to the extreme demand for change across Latin America, with IMF structural adjustment plans and other policies shaped by Wall Street orthodoxy by many governments, resulting in lower living standards and rising inequality. During the last year, we've witnessed an explosion of movements challenging the economic and political status quo around the world, like few other periods in history. We've seen the rise of popular movements engaged in a fight for a better world from the Middle East to North Africa to Spain, Greece, and Britain, and finally in the U.S., first in Wisconsin, and then the birth of the Occupy Wall Street movement in Liberty Plaza just a few blocks from here. But as we look to Latin America, we see countless examples of progressive movements over recent years that have successfully employed direct action tactics, some of which have transformed their societies. A few of these same tactics, of course, have been adopted by the Occupy movement, while others serve as an inspiration for future direct action campaigns. When Argentina faced economic collapse in 2001, as I know many of you understand, people from all classes in a miraculous period there came together in neighborhood assemblies, organizing politically by using consensus decision-making often, using alternative economic and actually creating alternative economic structures such as community gardens, soup kitchens, health clinics, and they also famously took over hundreds of businesses and factories that were run as democratic worker-run collectives, of which I understand some 300 still thrive today. Back in 2008, another story you all probably know, 250 workers at Republic Windows and Doors in Chicago followed this example, occupied the plant and won back wages and negotiated with new owners to take over the factory. The struggle was renewed last month when the new owners threatened to close down again, And workers now are engaged in another struggle, a second occupation, and are bidding to take over the plant to run them themselves in hopefully a cooperative model. Brazil's landless peasant movement, which we'll hear a lot more about today, or MST, has occupied and settled hundreds of thousands of families on some 35 million acres of land over the last 25 years. And I read that figure, and it's just amazing. 35 million acres of land. We'll hear more about it. This has inspired small-scale occupations in small steps here in the United States. Vacant lots and foreclosed homes in Florida and elsewhere. It's certainly been a focus of the Occupy movement in terms of doing sit-down strikes at occupied homes, or foreclosed homes, I should say. Cochabamba, Bolivia's successful fight in 2000 to stop the multinational corporation, the corporation Bechtel, from privatizing that city's water system, has served as an example for U.S.-based groups in Detroit and Atlanta to organize protests to keep their community's water utility in public hands. Beginning in 2011 in May, Chilean students, many of you also have been reading about, occupied hundreds of schools and universities and buildings as part of a direct action campaign to demand free education and an end to the state's corrupt relationship with private for-profit educational institutions that charge exorbitant tuition fees unaffordable to many in Chile. Our panelists today will explore the rich contemporary history of Latin America's diverse, dynamic progressive movements and the lessons Occupy activists in the U.S. and elsewhere can learn from their successes. And we'll start off our discussion today with Michael Fox. Michael is the editor of NACLA Report on the Americas. He's worked for many years as a freelance journalist, radio reporter, and documentary filmmaker covering Latin America. He's also co-author of the book Venezuela Speaks. I think we've got some right there. Voices from the Grassroots. And the co-director of the documentary films Beyond Elections, Redefining Democracy in the Americas, and Crossing the American Crises, From Collapse to Action, both available from the publisher, which I think has a booth downstairs, right?
Yeah.
And so we'll get started with Michael, and we'll be soon going to Snyder Arevalo, and then Nathan Schneider, and then make time for your questions and comments. Michael.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks, everyone, for being here. It's an honor to be at the Left Forum, and especially talking about occupying in Latin America. I think over the last year, and we've probably all felt this, this has been one of like the most tumultuous, exciting times for all of us. Obviously, that's the reason why we're kind of celebrating this theme of Occupy here at the Left Forum. And like Scott mentioned at the beginning, this is this is already what a lot of organizations, movements, and people were thinking and doing in Latin America for the last couple of decades. I'm going to talk, kind of break off from where Scott left things, and talk about, in a lot of different countries, about a lot of different movements, a lot of things that have been happening, especially with the tactic Occupy. What does this mean? How have people been able to use it? And then toss out a couple of different questions, which I think are really important for people to be thinking about, that maybe we can come back to later on. Economic crisis, Argentina, 2001, things are falling apart, and people stand up and say, what are we doing? I think one of the most important things that came out of that were the community assemblies that people kind of just started coming together and asking themselves and asking people on their street corners, what can we do? How can we how can we change things? How can we come together as a community? The piqueteros, basically workers without jobs, were blocking streets, demanding that they received support from the government. You had the recuperated factories. People were the factories that had been shut down, or the bosses just completely left, and workers were walking back and, occupying their factories again and actually getting them running and getting them going. And it wasn't just happening in Argentina. And I think that's one of the really important pieces. Throughout kind of the Mercosur, Southern Cone region, you had in Uruguay dozens of factories that were also occupied. In Brazil, factories were being occupied, kind of using the same tactic and the same model of Occupy. The other thing that you saw also in Uruguay was an organization called FUCMAN, which is this federation of cooperatives. and their housing cooperative. So it's not kind of an Occupy, but the idea, which had come out of the 19, it was actually founded in 1970, was that people can build their own homes. They can create their own communities. So we don't have to go and buy from somebody else. Let's come together. Let's get a piece of land and let's build our own areas together. Currently, there's 20,000 member families living in 400 different cooperatively formed kind of communities all across Uruguay. In Brazil, you not only have obviously the recuperative factors, you have the MST, the Landless People's Movement, which I'm not going to talk about, but obviously it's extremely important because Schneider will, I'm sure, talk a lot about it. So, but really, really profound and probably one of the movements where the concept of Occupy has been used over the last 26 years in amazing and powerful ways, and people have actually incorporated and acquired their own land. You also have the MNLM, which is the National Movement for the Struggle for Housing, which is also in Brazil, and several different other movements, and their idea is to occupy actual urban land. So kind of while the MST is out in the countryside, then the MNLM is doing it kind of in the urban, occupying apartments, apartment buildings. In 2005, at the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, the MNLM occupied an apartment building in downtown Porto Alegre. That building then, what the organization kind of transferred into, became known as Utopia y Luta, and it's now a cooperatively run building. You have all these different families that have come from the poorest communities in Porto Alegre, and they have their own homes there, and they have a bread, they have a bakery and a garden on the roof. And so these things are kind of happening all across Latin America, not just in Porto Alegre, in Rio and elsewhere. You know, one of the pieces that Ben always speaks to very, very well in his books and also when he's talking is about Paraguay and the campesinos there that have been struggling. I believe it's somewhere around 70% of the land in Paraguay is in the hands of 1% of the population. And so campesinos have really been organizing, trying to hold on to their land, especially with large agribusiness that has been kicking people off. One of those groups is called ASAGRAPA, the organization of farm workers from Alto Paraná, which is on the coast, the Brazilian kind of border between Paraguay and Brazil. And it's a region that used to be one of the most diverse regions in the world, and now it's almost completely desertified. And what you have is monocrop soy, genetically modified. And these campesinos are holding out in a lot of different areas, literally. They won't allow themselves to be pushed off their lands, and even with the fumigations and pesticides and whatnot, it's a really profound, another really profound story. One place that isn't talked about a whole lot when we talk about kind of the social movements and the struggles from below and from up above is Venezuela, because it gets so much rap in the media about, oh, Chavez, and things from top down. But it's really, 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 really profound, the amount of organizing on the grassroots, the way that the state has kind of called on people to organize, and that movement since 2001 have been doing this. The state, although it's, you know, is usually very supportive of these movements, it doesn't always kind of follow through with what the social movements wish they would do. And there's a lot of different movements that are this is happening to. There's the CTU, the Urban Land Committees, which were formed out of the land law, which happened in 2001, in which they basically said people can now acquire the rights to their homes, people in the poorest communities, the barrios and the favelas. And 300,000 families now have the rights were acquired through this land law of 2001. Through there, this group called the Pioneros was founded. And the idea of the pioneers, the Pioneros, was that they would be able to, you know, for those people in the poorest communities that have never been able to acquire their own land or have their own homes, the idea is to occupy land, occupy in urban land, and then build their own community through a communal process. It's been a long process. They've attempted several different occupations. They've finally achieved some of them, and that's the goal of the pioneers. And that's just one of several different movements, whether it's the campesinos and the National Campesino Movement, Isiko Zamora, which, and the whole goal is with campesinos occupying land, taking that land and actually acquiring it from the government through nationalizations. I think it's also really important to remember, going back in history, the barrios and the favelas, if we're talking about whether it's Venezuela or whether it's Rio de Janeiro, these are communities that came through and they needed land and they occupied it. They just took land along the hillsides. It's now, as I mentioned, through the urban land committees and through the land law, they're now acquiring the deeds and the titles to that land. But so it's not just, you know, right now, 2012, we're talking a lot about Occupy, and even after, you know, the neoliberal push of the 1990s, and we're talking about the last 20 years, but this is a tactic that's been used for centuries, you know, since the beginning of time. This is how we're going to demand our rights and demand what should be ours, especially in so many places with land consolidation, like Brazil, like Paraguay, like Venezuela, with land consolidation just through, you know, levels that are just through the roof. There's some really interesting cases of some cultural centers being occupied, also in Venezuela. There's a place called the Cuartel San Carlos, which is an old barracks, and then it was a prison. Actually, Hugo Chavez was held there in 92 after his attempted coup. And the former prisoners that were former guerrillas, leftist guerrillas under, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, they went back and they reoccupied this area once they found that cooperatives were actually, you know, they were supposed to be remodeling it into a museum, and they were selling off all of, like, the century-old materials for scrap metal and making off money. And the former prisoner said, it's not going to happen. And they occupied it, and it's now Cuartel San Carlos Libre, free. It's a cultural center. And that's where, if you were at the last talk, Dario Azzolini was talking about the communal councils and about promoters for the communal councils and how they've been forming communal councils in different communities around Venezuela, and they were doing some of the organizing for this at this location in Cuartel San Carlos. So these things are happening. It's really profound. Another location I think is really important just to throw out there is obviously Mexico and Zapatistas. John Holloway wrote a book, you know, Change the World Without Taking Power. And I think this is really deep and profound, and it goes to exactly what we're talking about, is occupying the space. It's not about we have to occupy this to then achieve this or ask for this demand. No, this is ours, and we're going to take it. And I think, in a sense, this is really important to remember, especially with the Occupy movement within the United States right now. So that's kind of like a historical look really quick at a bunch of different places within the region. But obviously, as Scott mentioned, over the last couple of years, it's been really deep and profound, especially with student movements, not just in Chile, which was last year, and also with the Penguin Revolution in 2006. But you had two different student strikes in Puerto Rico in 2010, 2011, which were really profound. People shutting down the schools, occupying spaces. The same thing was happening, if people remember, actually, out in California. And all of this, a lot of it was steps in response to either local pushes to further privatize education, or in the case of Puerto Rico, they tried to raise tuitions, and also out in California. Overnight, in April 2010, I believe it was, or was it April 2009, the school board of the University of California rose tuitions by 32%, and students occupied campuses all up and down California. You know, so these things, it's not just, you know, it's not just happening now. It's not just even with the Occupy movement. It's something that's been happening within the United States for several different years. Last year, for over a 2 or 3 month period in Honduras, they were trying to push through laws that would further privatize education in Honduras. And high school students in 150 schools in Honduras occupied their high schools. We don't hear a lot about these things. Same thing is happening in Colombia. Colombia students went on like a month-long strike last year, late last year, against Law 30, I believe, which was also going to further privatize education. So students across the region are standing up to defend their right to education. And NACLA, we have one of our latest issues is about that, is about the Latino student movements, which we just put out last year. Occupy movement also, obviously, it started after, you know, Egypt and after Chile and after the indignados in Spain and whatnot, you know, Occupy Wall Street right down the street. But they've also been doing that across Latin America. There's an Occupy Rio, that occupied a square in Cinelândia in downtown Rio de Janeiro for 40 days. And they're talking about reoccupying spaces all around Brazil in the coming months. So these things, also, I think in Mexico also there was like kind of Occupy someplace, and it's happened in a bunch of different cities all around Latin America. So it's not just a phenomenon that's happening here, and people are really picking up on that. One of the things I really wanted to talk to briefly that I think is really important with all of this Occupy, and it doesn't matter where it's happening or in what case it's happening, there's really two steps to it. There's the action of actually occupying the space, standing up and taking it, and then there's the decision-making process. And I think that's been what's been really profound, not just over the last year with, you know, Occupy movement along the United States, but in Latin America in general, is that people have always really focused on this participatory democracy, direct democracy, consensus decision-making, or if we have to vote, well, then let's do it in a way where we're coming together and really uniting. I think that that's really important when we're thinking about these tactics and thinking about occupying all these different spaces. The other thing that's really interesting and kind of separates this moment of this kind of Occupy movement from a lot of these other cases around Latin America in the past is a lot of these other cases were happening because people were demanding, for instance, campesinos in Venezuela were going to demand land, and we're going to occupy this land, and this is the land we want. Or the MST, we're going to occupy this, we're going to take this, and this is what we want to do. Recuperated factories, we want to occupy this factory, this is our factory, we're going to take it back, we're going to have it. Or, for instance, the MTD in Argentina, the disoccupied workers' movement, we're going to occupy a space in front of City Hall until we're going to get the local government to actually give us a pension that we deserve. What's interesting about this Occupy movement time is obviously Occupy Wall Street, we're going to occupy this, we're going to hold this space, but there's not a clear, there's the demand question, which I'm sure that, you know, people are talking about now, we've been talking about for a long time. But it almost, in a way, kind of separates out. It's almost kind of a new way of looking at this. And like I said, even when, you know, we have Occupy Rio, they're thinking the same thing. So I think that that's a question that's important that obviously has been debated for months and months, but it's important to look at the difference between all these other different occupying spaces and moments, these cases of, you know, kind of taking back what is rightfully what is rightfully ours, and that's what you see down here at Wall Street, of people taking this back, Zuccotti Park. But then again, you also have this kind of difference this time, which in some ways harkens back to like the community assemblies that were happening in Argentina after the crisis of 2001, where what are we going to do? Let's come together and we're going to decide together what we're going to do. How are we going to resolve this problem that we have in this community? Well, this is what we're going to do about it, and this is how we're going to resolve it. And we're going to do it through democracy. And we're going to do it through our assemblies at the time, and so I think that I'm gonna stop there. Except for the only one thing I was going to say is that I guess that's one of the interesting things that we've seen over, you know, Occupy Wall Street with Occupy the Hood and with the movement towards more occupying and supporting homes and families that are being kicked out of their homes due to foreclosures. And that way you kind of see this kind of demand again. Oh, no, we're occupying this because this is ours. And so I think this is a question I'd like to kind of bat around over the next like hour and a half, because I think this is interesting, and it is one of like the major differences between a lot of the tactics that have been used in the past, especially around Latin America, and kind of the direction that some things are going, not just in the United States but elsewhere. What does that actually mean? What does it mean for us? What does it mean for the Occupy movement? What does it mean for movements in Latin America? The last thing I just wanted to end on is what Ben Dangle always talks about is the dance between the state and the social movements. You know, in a lot of these different countries, what we've seen are, for instance, in Venezuela, where you have a friendly government that is actually calling on the people to occupy. We want you to do this. We want you to take over the factories. Does that always mean that the government's going to fulfill and actually pass that factory down to the workers? Obviously not. It doesn't always happen. We were in 2009. I was in Ospino. It's called the Ospino, what do we call it? Meat packing factory. Workers took it over in May of 2006. They held on to it. it's been great, but they haven't gotten any support from the Venezuelan government. So you have these kind of these contradictions in this process. And then you have other cases where the government is completely in conflict with kind of the occupation, with the movement. Some cases, for Brazil, it was like that for a long time. And then there's obviously difficulties now, even with leftist, with the PT, with the Workers' Party in power and whatnot. So it's a huge issue. There's a lot going on there, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Mike.
Sure.
Our next panelist is Esnara Arevalo. Is a New York City-based member of Friends of the MST, a network of individuals and organizations that support the Brazilian Landless Workers Movement, MST, in the struggle for social and economic justice while securing respect for human rights. Esnara is a native of Colombia and has been active in Latin American solidarity work for more than two decades. He joined Friends of MST after working directly with MST in Brazil during the year 2003. We're really happy you could be joining us today, and thank you, Snyder.
Okay, thank you for having us. Hello, everybody. My first question will be to everybody. How many people here are familiar with the MST, and do you know what they do? Okay, that's a good number. There's a few who don't. So I'm going to give a really quick review of what they are and what they do. They've been around for since 1984. And they formed for the basic need of seeking land reform and having a quantitative distribution of land in Brazil. Since 1984 until now, they have grown to a movement that is well over 2 million people. They currently hold, like I was said before, over 35 million acres of land, and they actually provide about 60%, up to 60% of all the agricultural products of Brazil, which is tremendous. They have really basic goals, which are to fight for land, land reform, and to strive for a more just and fraternal society. Simple. From there, from that basic organization, the movement evolves every day and it changes, and how they do it is through a really inclusive democratic system. They are organized in, okay, let's start from the beginning before they even take over the land. What they do is they start an encampment, and an encampment is simply a tent city made out of plastic bags, black plastic bags, where they start gathering people who are landless peasants. As word spreads out of an encampment being created, the all landless people who want to participate in the movement, they start gathering, and that's where the process really starts. And it may take years from that point until they actually move onto the land. So once they do that, they start organizing in families, work groups, and they create representatives. I always have to be a gendered parity on every working group. There has to be a man and a woman represented for everybody in the group. And then it moves on to the city level, the state level, the national level. Their congress takes place anywhere between 5 and 10 years, which is the national congress that encompasses all the groups in Brazil. The last one was in 2007. Okay, now, once they gather in encampments and they start working on the needs of the community, which means a collectivization process. Everybody has to gather and decide what they need to do and where they want to go. And they have to decide whether or not everybody is properly educated, which the answer, as we know, is usually no. So they have to start creating an education group, work group, health and nutrition work group, gender work group, and so on. Then they start doing a survey of how many families and how many members each family has, and what the needs are, how many children, how many elders, and all that. Throughout this whole process, and I'm going to simplify it, and I'm putting it as short as I can, and then we can take questions about what people have curiosity about. They then start surveying the land around them and see what land that's could be used for agriculture is idle. And here is something that's really interesting in Brazil. Brazil, the Brazilian Constitution has two articles, Article 184 and 186, that says that any land that is idle, that is not fulfilling its social goal, could be expropriated and then turned into people who want to work it. And that is the legal basis that they use to occupy land. And so they will eventually figure out a land that fulfills the requirements. They, after working for sometimes months or years in encampments, they will pick up one night and move 20, 30, 40, 100, 150 families and move them onto this land, and they'll take it overnight. Once they take over the land, then it becomes a situation of waiting to see what happens, having a legal strategy, and having the people themselves. We're not talking about the leadership of the movement per se is not doing this. The masses are doing it. Then they have to wait for the response, and then they go in front of a judge, and they argue their case. And this is where the part where it can become dangerous, because the people who may feel that they have ownership of this land legally may employ paramilitary forces or thugs to try to forcibly remove them. And then they'll also try to bribe the judges to have a favorable outcome to them, and so on. So I'm going to go with the most positive outcome, which is the land is idle and it fulfills the requirements of the law and it can be nationalized, which is actually what happens. Then the land gets distributed to the landless peasant movement, and those families that stay there, because not necessarily all the families stay there, which is another really difficult part of the process, is the land may not be enough to sustain all the families that were in the encampment. Those who stay there, they go on a whole different struggle. Those who don't, they move on to the next encampment, and the process starts all over again. Once they take over the land and they start a process of collectivization of the land, where they want to go with it, what they want to do, and then they become a settlement. They are already settled, and they start building more stable housing, food cooperatives, etc. So that, in a nutshell, is how it works. And of course, I'm omitting a tremendous amount of work that goes behind all this. And then after they collectivize the land, they are supposed to start producing, and then they have a duty to the people who were left out, who are either because they didn't fit in the land, or the people who are coming behind them who are forming new encampments. And the process keep going. So that, in a nutshell, is what the landless peasant movement is and what they do and how they occupy land. After that, they also have decided, because the system have failed them on every level, education and so on, which the compañera spoke earlier about the education systems in Brazil, and the MST education systems. They have created their own school systems. They have, but all under the government system, because their intention is not to take power to replace government, it's simply to force the government to be a more just and fair society. So that, in a nutshell, is what the MST, and that's what they do, and that's how they occupy land.
And we're certainly, I'm sure there's a lot of questions for all of our panelists, and we'll make enough time for that after our next and last speaker. Just a note here that we have a sign-up sheet going around, and we'll have this and some other panels we've recorded up on our website so that people can share this, you know, with other folks who may be interested. So if you want to sign up with your email, we'll send you information and how to subscribe to our other material at Between the Lines. Nathan Schneider is our next panelist. He's an editor of WagingNonviolence.org, for which he began covering the planning meetings of the Occupy Wall Street action back in August of 2011. His writing about the Occupy movement is on the cutting edge and has appeared in many periodicals all across the country and the world, including the Occupied Wall Street Journal, born out of the OWS movement, Harper's, The Nation, even the New York Times, Title, the new theory magazine of the Occupy movement, the Boston Review, and elsewhere. We're really happy Nathan could be here today. He's obviously his mind is focused on the Occupy movement and what happened today. Of course, many of you understand there was a reoccupation of Zuccotti Park. So maybe briefly, before you start your conversation about this topic, update our audience here as to what happened today in Zuccotti Park in Liberty Square.
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty restless today. It's hard to be in a conference room because the park is full again. You know, I've spent all day running around with a march down on Wall Street, and there have been kind of scuffles with the police all afternoon. And actually, I just checked on Twitter. There's a line of police on one side of the park, so it looks like there may be some action any minute now. There's also talk about a kind of secret reoccupation plan happening right about now or near now. So there's a lot of occupation happening in our neighborhood right now. It's a very poignant time to have this conversation. I feel a little out of my league in this conversation. My knowledge of the Latin American movements is small but growing. But I'm really grateful to be a part of it. At Waging Nonviolence, the site that I edit, co-edit, we really try to talk about contemporary ongoing movements that we're working with very closely, like Occupy, in the context of a much broader vision of historical movements and also movements going on around the world. So we've been carrying reports about movements in Latin America and all over the place and trying to bring them into the conversation within the Occupy movement. And so this kind of conversation is really exciting. I'm going to talk a little bit, I'm going to focus on the role of occupation in Occupy Wall Street. A lot of you probably, this is probably a review for a lot of you. I hope that it's, I hope that you learned something. In terms of the prehistory, the kind of first inklings of this idea came actually in late January while people were still camped out in Tahrir Square. Adbusters put out a blog post floating the idea of a million-man march on Wall Street, and they got lots of responses. And so over the subsequent months, they started developing this idea or this concept, this really marketing pitch to Occupy Wall Street. And then, of course, Madison came. The May 15th movement in Spain came. There was actually a little-known attempt to occupy Zuccotti Park on June 14th in New York City. That was organized by some people through Anonymous, the online network. 16 people showed up, and 4 were willing to occupy, so that didn't really work out. But again, the idea was kind of in motion. That same day, an occupation in New York City called Bloombergville did get going, and it would end up lasting for 3 weeks. It was against budget cuts in the city, and some people who were part of that Zuccotti Park attempt, which was actually organized by a group called A99, I mean, they were also talking about this 99% idea, became a part of Bloombergville, and then Bloombergville, the folks who organized Bloombergville and who carried it out, ended up being the ones who made the call after the Adbusters announcement and eventually went out in July to start planning for this idea of Occupy Wall Street. At the same time, I started going to the Occupy planning meetings in August. I was also going to the meetings of a group planning to occupy Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., a totally separate effort to occupy a major symbolic space in the United States with a lot of similar aims. And this was an older group, very different group. They succeeded in occupying. They're still there, and they're still doing their thing. But it was really a testament to me to the fact that, like, this idea was really in the air, and the aspiration of prolonged occupation was out there. It was happening simultaneously in a lot of groups. Those planning meetings were really important. They started taking the first one was at the Raging Bull statue, then the Irish Famine Memorial, and then the rest of them were at Tompkins Square Park here in New York. This was for Occupy Wall Street. Those meetings themselves became occupations. I mean, it was the organizers often reminded themselves that you can't have more than 20 people gathered in a New York City park without a permit. So this group, which could range between 60 and 100 people, was carrying out an occupation just to have meetings in public. And during those meetings, the idea of what the occupation would be really shifted. You know, Adbusters proposed this idea of just occupying Wall Street and making one demand and trying to get it passed, accepted, trying to win a measurable victory. That wasn't what the organizers at these meetings ended up going for. A lot of them came with ideas of one demands, but they could never agree on anything. And so they actually kind of fell in love with the process in the course of those meetings, so that by the end, it was that process of direct democracy that was really more exciting to them than any demand that they could possibly pick. And the influence of the Latin American movements was present, if sometimes subtle, in those meetings. I mean, one person who helped facilitate them was Marina Citrin, who had deep experience in Argentina, and wrote a book called Horizontalism about those movements. Her influence was really important. There were Brazilians there. There were also people from Spain and people from Greece. It was a very international crowd, a very international conversation. And it was really in those meetings that what would become Occupy Wall Street was formed, rather than simply the Adbusters idea. So that occupation became generative. Now, it was interesting, on the first night, on September 17th, when this group of 2,000 people, it was supposed to be 20,000, but it was just 2,000, tried to occupy this park, there was a lot of controversy over whether this was good enough. You know, they had come to occupy Wall Street, and they had been led by the tactics committee and among the planners to Zuccotti Park just because it seemed more feasible. And there were a lot of people who were like, I'm not going to bed until I'm on Wall Street, you know, and there was a lot of argument about, you know, is this enough? Is this good enough? And then a week later, again, the whole thing had shifted. People had fallen in love with this park. Now the movement is torn about the idea of whether it can even exist if it doesn't exist in this park. You know, it has become such an important space. So I think that emotional attachment that people create to the occupied space is really important. That sense in which it becomes your home. I think that human beings have this deep sense of home, and that kind of clicks in an occupation like this, and you become attached. And then, of course, what happened very quickly after that was not simply Occupy Wall Street, but Occupy Everywhere. You know, these occupations showing up all over the country and around the world. And this, again, was the hope of the planners in Tompkins Square Park. They started thinking, again, less about just Wall Street, but about spreading this idea of organizing and having general assemblies and occupying all over the place. And that became more important to them than simply occupying Wall Street. And so the kind of mood that emerged from those meetings was really generative. And it was such a difference from the ways that protests had been taking place in the United States for a long time. I mean, I like to compare this movement, which started with really just 100 or so people occupying those first nights, to the march on Wall Street with 20,000 people on May 12th, which was organized by a variety of groups around the city. You know, massive demonstration against the banks, a lot of the same concerns expressed, but very little media coverage. I've done a lot of searching around for evidence for records of this day, and there are very few articles about it, even though it was such a large number of people. So something about this occupation, even though it was such a small number of people, had a profound effect in capturing people's imaginations. And in comparison with a lot of the occupations that we've been talking about here, this was not ostensibly a productive space. It wasn't producing food or it wasn't working as a factory. In some ways, it was largely symbolic. It was a place that was visible, that was that reporters could come to and see. And then it was also a place for movement building and for community building and a place where connections and conversations were happening all the time. And it inspired people to think about ways to start occupying productive spaces. And that's still a conversation that happens a lot in the movement. You know, a lot of people are aware of these kinds of examples, but I don't think they've really come out in scale. I mean, even the home occupations are nowhere near the scale that had been that was reached in Spain, for instance. I mean, the scale is still very small, and it's in fits and starts. And a lot of people are working to try to build this into a real, you know, into a scalable effort. But that hasn't happened yet. And what has been happening is that in the last few months, since the eviction in November, there have been a lot of a few attempts at reoccupations or new occupations, and these have been really controversial in the movement. And there's been a lot of discussion about how central this tactic really is to the movement, whether this is the where energy should be spent, whether an occupation is necessary for movement building, as it so felt like, you know, as it felt in the fall, or whether the movement should kind of move on to campaigns and mass actions, you know, other kinds of things that would you know, threaten the power of the financial industry and those who have the stranglehold on American politics. And this debate continues. I mean, the question of occupation is playing out as we speak right now. You know, as some people again think that pushing these occupations is the way to keep the movement alive, others are working on things like trying to bring down Bank of America, you know, without necessarily occupying very much. There's also this issue in which Occupy has become a brand, you know, and this is something that comes up and that makes people often very uncomfortable because of the association with corporate branding, you know. Is something associated with the movement if it doesn't in some sense occupy? You know, can it be? Can something be a part of this kind of cohesive network of solidarity if it doesn't involve an occupation? You know, that's a question that comes up. And actually, you know, some groups have renamed, you know, De-Occupy, I think in the Southwest, or the Oakland Commune. At a meeting the other day, a group of people actually blocked some language for some flyers that involved the word occupy. This was an occupy meeting, and some people were so uncomfortable with the word that they wanted to keep it from being on flyers. So that kind of, you know, they want to resist this tendency toward branding. You know, one other thing that just came to mind with the mention of the Chilean students is that one of the new undertakings in the movement, which I explain in depth in a piece in the current issue of The Nation, is called the Plus Brigades. It's an attempt to, it was really a response to this debate in the movement about violence and nonviolence and tactics, and it was an attempt to bring new life into the tactics of the movement on the streets. And a lot of the inspiration came from the Chilean student movement and the kind of colorful actions that they're doing on the streets, sometimes literally colorful, like paint bombs at cops and things like that. And so right now, as the movement has been kind of suffering a crisis of imagination and of energy, it's been looking a lot of people have been looking around for inspiration around the world, and Latin America is one of the most one of the kind of richest sources that people have been drawing on. Finally, one other thing that I've been noticing in the last couple of days, the anti-capitalista chant has been really, really, I mean, this was not so popular in the fall, but this is happening all the time now, and it's really getting people going. And so again, it's another example of international solidarity kind of refreshing and renewing the movement. At the end, I'd like to conclude just by pointing to this kind of what I think of as Occupy metaphysics or linguistics. I mean, it's like a very interesting process in the course of this movement from the beginning is that people are playing with the word and playing with what it means to occupy. And I think anybody who occupies anything will start to do this. What does this word mean? It's got all sorts of connotations. People from the beginning would talk about occupying your heart, you know, occupying in ways that are not visible and literal, but which would be transformative from within, perhaps. And that kind of reevaluation of words and meanings and locations. A lot of people today were wearing signs that said "This space is occupied," you know, on themselves, and that was it was all over the place today. You know, there's, I think, a real interest in playing with this sense of what space is, what occupation is, and that continues to be an evolving question in this movement. Thank you.
Thanks to all of our panelists. I think, you know, we've got a really good diversity of information here in terms of how the Latin American movements, that as has been said, is so diverse and so rich and has succeeded in so many ways, can inspire and instruct the movement here as it goes to a new phase. And we want to get to your questions here, but I'll just make one quick note about the branding thing. People from the New York area may remember this crazy ad on New York radio. I think it was a New Jersey area Toyota dealer. He said, "Come on down and occupy your brand new Prius." This is like in October or November. And I said, "My God, this is insane." But anyway, let's get your questions. I thought we could organize this maybe by getting three questions at a time, because there's 45 minutes left and we want to make sure to get everybody in here. And then our panelists can respond. Does that sound like it'll work? You want to go ahead first? Sure. Come on up and just speak in the microphone.
Thank you. I'll try to make this short and not overly theoretical, but it strikes me, listening to the three presentations, that the first two are sort of grounded in materialism, you know, to use Marxist terminology. The third is Hegelian, you know. So here we have kind of materialism versus idealism, you know. What does it mean to occupy symbolic space? What does it mean to occupy yourself? What does it mean to occupy something that has no material basis in reality? How do you challenge economic power structures? How do you challenge the state by occupying parks and finally your brain and finally a brand? You know, so I'll just leave it at that, but I'd be interested in hearing you guys bat that around.
First of all, congratulations to the panelists, because you've done something that most panels never do, which is include experiences from the South as well as from the North. Very rarely happens in these panels, so congratulations. A few points. As a participant of the Occupy movement in Toronto, I want to make a couple points that are critical but self-critical because I'm part of the movement. One is that most of this rejection of liberal institutions and dominant institutions, I'm talking about Latin America, is obviously critical because we're occupying, we're doing participatory democracy, which is different from just voting, and which is very important. However, they have led to a number of interesting things in Latin America, namely the election of a bunch of basically populist governments that in some ways are not totally with a radical process. I'm thinking here not only of the Kirchners in Argentina, but also, I would say, even Chavez and Morales. So I think those are good things to have in mind. The other point is that, I think, Michael, you mentioned that when you occupy something, you make it ours. And you reference some of the cooperatives, the MST, and so forth. But here, I would also be slightly critical and say, yes, it's ours to a certain degree, but those values that we create in every day participating in these co-ops, they're constantly being, let's say, dominated by the values of the market, because they're actually operating within the market. So the MST, for example, has a network of cooperatives that makes about $50 million a year in revenues. That should, you know, make some lights sort of flash in terms of what it is that they're doing exactly. I'm totally for it, but we should, again, be self-critical as far as that goes. Maybe I'll leave it at that, and maybe let people comment on that.
Okay, if we get one more, we'll just have the panelists come at it.
We've seen how the slogan, the 1% versus the 99%, triggered a discussion of class interest in the United States, perhaps for the first time since the 1930s. And this led to a labor Occupy alliance, which signaled a sea change and a potentially revolutionary change or leap in the movement here in the United States. Could you all reflect on that same, the parallel situations in the movements in Latin America and in this country? Also, you know, just your, all your reflections just on the, that sort of local peasant action, which may have led to alliances which had more greater class and thereby revolutionary implications.
Sure. So a couple of thoughts, and we could probably talk for hours about this. I'll keep this really short, though. Pierre, it's a good question. I'm glad you asked it. I'm looking. Also, if anybody else has any thoughts too, you know, this is a democracy. So if anyone else wants to throw anything out, I think the one of the most profound things for me, whether it's with the MST, or with even the Chilean movements, is this sense of creativity, is the sense of, the MST has what they call a mística. I don't know if anyone knows, does anyone know what that means, mística? So basically the idea is it's kind of like rooting what you're doing in a spiritual base, grounding it in something that goes back to the history. So for instance, I participated in the final march of a group of people way down in Rio Grande do Sul in southern Brazil. It was in 2008. They had just finally acquired land. They had literally been living under these black plastic tarps for 5 years. And we were marching to the land where these people were going to receive their land. And the night before, we camped out. The next morning, we woke up at dawn. And then the people that led the way were dressed up as if like they were pioneers from like the 1800s. They had an oxen and a cart that was pulling them along. When they got to the front gate of this latifundio that had literally struggled against them for years, two people went out and they broke it with an axe. They broke the lock, pushed the gate open. And so this is that sense of, it's not just, oh, we have to occupy this, but rooting this into something deeper, into something more profound. And I think that this is really, really important, especially going forward. It's something that a lot of movements do really well. I know the movement in Venezuela, Ezequiel Zamora Campesino Front, has learned from the MST. There's been a lot of MST folks that have come there. And this is one of the things, because it's not just saying, it's spiritual. It's not just, oh, we have to believe in this religion. It's not we have to believe in this. But it's rooting it to our past and our history, remembering where we come from and where are we going and why do we believe this. I think that that's really, really profound, because it's not just, oh, we have to take this. But it's actually going deeper, and it's and it builds this connection between us and our past and our future. So I just want to throw that out there. The other thing is obviously creativity, and the Chilean students have been wonderful with this, and a lot of different movements there. You know, exciting, interesting, whether it's a kiss in or whatever. You know, colorful marches and things like that. I think that we need to also be thinking about how we can always be kind of groundbreaking and at the same time be making the connection to the past, the present, and the future. I think that that's really important. The question about populist governments, it is an important question. I hate the word populist to describe the present governments in Latin America, the left governments in Latin America, because in a lot of ways, they don't always fall into the model of Perón and Vargas in Brazil and everything. So for me, I can't stand it. But I completely understand your point. Is saying, well, now these social movements have brought these kind of leftist governments to power, which in many ways, what's the role that they're playing? I would say that in Venezuela, myself having been there a long time, there is kind of this difficult relationship with the social movements and the governments. At one point, on one hand, supportive, and at the same time, very contradictory at times, depending on the bureaucracy, who's there. There's a revolution within the revolution. Obviously, he was trying to push it more to the left. I think that regardless, without a doubt, these are realities, and these contradictions is what you would find with almost any one of these governments that would come to power. And I know that the cases of, especially with Correa and Morales, are even more complicated, especially with the indigenous movements. And there are other people in this room that can speak to that a lot better than I can. But I think that that is an important question to ask. What is the relationship, and how are these social movements then dancing with these governments, and how can they push for more? And I know that that's a case with Brazil and the MST right now. Under Lula and under Dilma, the MST is very clear that under Lula gave less land to the MST than the previous neoliberal governments did. So what's the reality here? What's actually going on? And at the same time, you see right now with Dilma Rousseff, who's the government, obviously, Workers' Party government, who kind of came in at the very beginning of last year after Lula, and she's now been trying to gut environmental legislation to really promote agribusiness, mining, and that's the way that Brazil is so economically, it's now the sixth largest economy in the world because of the fact that it's really been pushing its genetically modified industry and, making good friends with Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland and Bunge and all this. And that's how they're growing their economy, really. So all of this, so that's a really complicated question. And it's true, the MST, I think that we can't be afraid of, cooperatives. Yes, cooperatives, they play within the market. That's the reality of the system. I think the idea is that because of the fact that it's collective, it's cooperatively produced, then we don't have one person in control of power, and the idea can be rooted in the local. And I think it's important. If the MST is going to survive, it has to find a way to do it sustainably, and that's the thing. Sustainably, not just environmental sustainability, but labor also. Well, anyway, I'll pass on. I've been speaking long enough. So,
I just want to add one short thing about the I think everybody's seen it by now. about the relationship of the MST and the current government, which it comes up all the time. He touched on the fact that Dilma took over Lula, and the PT was supposed to be the leftist populist party. The MST as a movement does not participate in electoral politics. Their members can participate. I mean, they are encouraged to, and they can belong to any political party they want. It is true a large chunk of them probably have belonged to the MST at one point or another. And I'm going to give you kind of more of a personal answer of my own, the people that I have talked. A lot of them have become disillusioned and have left the party. And but the movement itself does not directly participate in electoral politics, and any member of the MST that wishes to become part of the electoral politics has to leave the movement. So they have friends who are supported by people who are elected at state level, city level, national level, and they are supported by them. But they are very clear on their point. And another thing that they made really clear when I have talked to them and have lived with them and all that is that the way they describe it is, it's great to have this populist government. However, the government will go wherever it gets pushed. So if you have this huge amount of weight from the right and the multinational corporations pushing them this way, it is the duty of everybody and the workers and the people to get up on this side and push the other way. And that's the only way things are going to get done for the rest of us, and that's how they see it. And I think he made it really clear on the mediums of production they have. We all need to eat, and we all need to get through in the system, and that's the way it is right now. But they are really clear about what the ultimate goal is and where they want to go with this, which is a more egalitarian society for everyone. That's why they have, everybody has voice and everything can be criticized from top to bottom. And that is one of the things that is frustrating about the MST movement, is how long it takes for every little decision to be made. It has to be brought up from the ground level all the way to the national level on every level, state, city, so on and so forth, and then go back down. So everything takes a long, long process.
Thank you.
I'd just like to make, I found really fruitful the distinction between materialism and idealism as well as the question about the basis of a revolutionary movement. And that made me think, on the one hand, about the fact that a lot of these movements, especially the MST here, is about serving the people who are participating, are providing for themselves through the movement. And that's something that, again, Occupy does mainly on a symbolic level. I mean, a lot of people are going broke in the process of this. They're not finding the means to support their families. And, you know, I talked earlier about the foreclosure issue and occupying homes. And one of the things I think that the Spanish movement really did right is that they began in May, really, dealing with foreclosures because people within the movement were suffering foreclosures. And so they, like, fellow activists kind of teamed up and helped one another, you know, and I think that's why it became so strong there, and why it was really able to gain steam. And one thing that some people are working on in the Occupy movement is to try to get this model of eviction defense and occupation into churches and other sorts of communities that already exist in the United States, where people can kind of support one another, and where the need, rather than simply kind of in a vanguardist way identifying a home that, you know, the movement thinks needs to be occupied, instead trying to support one another in their crises, you know, with the system. Finally, I was just really struck, again, the materialism, idealism issue brought this up. I mean, there were so many op-eds about Occupy Wall Street in the fall. There was so much ink spilled about the movement. Yet, you know, there was this op-ed in the last week in the New York Times by an outgoing Goldman Sachs employee, you know, who is sad that the company isn't treating its basically oil baron clients well enough. And it actually affected the stock price. You know, it could be argued that and it was just such a reminder to me that you know, the movement still has not developed the capacity to materially affect those whom it's targeting.
Want to just come on up and speak in the mic?
So I had a question about the Occupy movement, actually, but in a context of, I'm having this personal dilemma with the Occupy movement where I actually missed the movement. So I was just in Brazil for 2 years, and I was working with the MST for 2 years. And there was a lot of things that I really, really resonated with me with the MST and that I learned from them. And one of the things as a political activist that really resonated with me was this idea of submitting to the collective. When you're part of the MST, you lose your individuality. When you become a militante and you submit yourself to the decisions of the collective, that's the language they use. And the second thing that was really profound for me about the MST was the strict hierarchy within the movement. It's a collective hierarchy. You have collectives at all points in the process, but there's a very clear hierarchy of collectives that then have representatives of that collective that go to other collectives. And when the higher collectives make decisions and define the lines, the political direction of the movement, the lower collectives can't just go against that. There's this strict hierarchy of participatory governance, of participation, but there's a hierarchy within it. And the third one is discipline. There's this huge amount of discipline in the MST. And if you're a militante and if you don't show up for a meeting, if you're not following the discipline of the movement, you're no longer part of it. And so learning that from the MST, I came back in January, and I'm a dedicated political activist, and I live in Oakland. And so I went to, you know, check out the political scene of Occupy Oakland, and because it was really inspiring to see something happen in the United States that I was proud of while in Brazil and that I could talk about. And I feel, and again, I only have 2.5 months trying to check out the political scene, but I have this feeling about Occupy Oakland that it's this extreme of reform of individualism, where the only way you can participate is going to a GA as an individual and voicing your opinion as an individual. And it's this form of horizontalism and participation, but in a very individualistic way that didn't feel the same as the MST felt to me in Brazil. And so I'm trying to, being a dedicated activist, wanting to be involved in the political movements in Oakland, I'm trying to come to terms with that. And so that's a question for you, and I don't know if you wanted to chirp into about the MST as well, but yeah.
Thanks for that. excellent question. It really brings everything together. You want to come up and just say, one next?
Can I just speak from here? So my name is Jeannie, and so my question is about the MST. I was very interested to hear about it. And my question is there any attempt by the people in the MST to reach out and unite with people in the cities, the movements in the cities?
Okay, I think my question is about, like, what is the perspective of a horizontal movement in Latin America in terms of, well, you know, Latin America has a whole different scenario in the left, like saying, because of our history, our political parties are very involved with social movements, and the activists, in a way, they are always relating to political parties. And I went to Brazil just a month ago, and I saw, well, the scenario was Occupy São Paulo that I met. It's a very isolated group, because it is the topic of being co-optated in the scenario is very complicated, because what you see is a very fragmented left, right, because of history. And the fragmentation happened, and it's a very, like, it's a very hard, it's hard to unite the left in Latin America. And so when the Occupy movement arrived there, it arrived as something that was completely different, because horizontal organization is something that would challenge this competition of power that actually exists inside the left, because there are political parties and there are people who are running for elections and who are organizing. So there is, like, there is power inside the left, and there is a complicated scenario. And so my question is, what is the perspective of, actually, is it possible to unite this movement, Occupy movement, and this traditional left? And yeah. And the other question is about, like, the optimism. Like, what you guys think about this optimism going on in Brazil right now, like, becoming this powerful economy at the same time, like, in the hands of Monsanto, while, like, undermining the fight of MST, and how this optimism actually, like, can undermine the potential of Occupy, for example.
Oh, yeah, sure. Just on that comment about Occupy Oakland, I think that's a really rich experience that you've had, and I hope it's one that you share. I mean, the issue of discipline is really, I've found to be a really bad word in the Occupy movement. And, you know, autonomy is very privileged. It's a word you hear a lot. I think it's an important word. I think it, you know, so much of the movement strength comes from this experience of self-expression that people are having, that people feel a deep need for. And I think that's a source of its power. But I think on some level, as the movement matures, people are going to have to learn, if not hierarchy, I think responsibility at least, and accountability is a word that's being talked about a lot. You know, if you're acting autonomously in an action and it endangers the people around you, you know, there's a problem. And unfortunately, I think there are a lot of problems in the movement that are coming out of this sort of overemphasis on autonomy and individualism, and you know, and I think actually this could be a case where movements collectivized, horizontal, especially movements from around the world, can provide examples for people in the Occupy movement of how you can do something that looks like discipline or accountability or mutual responsibility without it being oppressive. So I think this is a really fruitful place for drawing inspiration from other movements. Thank you for that.
Sure. Okay, about the MST, I'm not going to give a really quick general answer to that. They do create alliances with other groups, indigenous movements and urban movements and all that. And that's something that actually, since the time I started working with them, has changed dramatically. They didn't used to do as much work with indigenous groups a few years back, and which was something that I always wondered. And now they are, it's a new topic that has been finally brought up into the core. So they have they learn. It's a movement that continues to learn and continues to create links, and they finally have a great international office now that is in charge of people like me that we're accountable to. They are the ones who coordinate the international solidarity work, and they are also now, for example, they are under this really intense need to speak other languages other than Portuguese. While I was there, one of the things that happened to me was that I was drafted into translating a lot for people, because I speak my native language is Spanish, and then English as a second language, and third is Portuguese. So I got drafted into translating for a lot of events and things, and they discovered the need to have them learn English because they want to create these links, international links with people here. A few months ago, someone from the MST came and spoke at Zuccotti Park during the Occupy days when everybody was encamped there. So, for example, now we are under a lot of, we've been requested basically to make a structure in which people from the MST can come to English-speaking countries to study for periods of time so they can pick up language, so they can create these links with people here so they themselves can communicate. So it is very important to them. As far as we can sit and talk for hours about the cultural shock of the United States and how it works on the discipline factor and how they activate. It's two different realities. It's my own personal things that I start getting into. In the United States, people don't even believe a lot of the times that there is class issues. It's really difficult for them to discern class. And here in the United States, again, this is my problem, I almost feel like taking the hat off. People confuse race with class, for example, a lot of the time. And things like that. So it is more confusing here because people don't have the basics of that understanding of how things work in society. We're only now learning. All of a sudden, there is this concept of the 99%. And all of a sudden, it's what is the 99%? It's not about race anymore, and that's what's fresh about it. Well, in Brazil and Latin America and Colombia, class is where it's at. Even though it is still identified with race, you know, indigenous people, Morales is the first indigenous president in Bolivia, and Colombia has never had a black or indigenous president, you know. So there is still race issues, and we're still a racist society, and a sexist society. I mean, we're still having the first female presidents, and this whole panel is male. I don't know if you guys noticed that, you know. So we still have a lot of issues to deal with, and so it is different speeds, and the United States has been able to afford a more comfortable living, you know, a middle class that is diminishing, the old union jobs are disappearing, you know, so all of a sudden the reality is catching up with the rest of the world, and I think that's where you're going to start seeing more disciplined militants coming up here. So that's how I see it. I mean, again, we can talk hours about it. It was a culture shock to me when I went there, even though I came from Colombia. I went there, what private property is, what my things were, what their things were. It's amazing. And one of these stories I always tell people, I was in a settlement, which is, you know, already have houses and they work collectively, and it's really nice in the countryside. And we were walking down the main street, and it was going to start raining, and Salech, who's the woman I work with there, said we should go into Rita's house, her area, and pick up her clothes because they're all hanging on, you know, drying in the sun. And so we went in there, and my reaction was pick it up, and I was going to put them in the chair that was in the little hole under the roof, the edge of the house. And she thought, Saleche thought that was very impolite of me. The right thing to do was walk into Rita's house and fold her clothes for her and put them away. You know, and to us in our American system, it was like we're gonna walk into someone's house without their permission and fold their clothes. You understand what I'm saying? Is that difference of how we see private property and what is it's proper. And she thought I was very rude to just saying that I was just gonna dump her clothes there and walk away. And Rita was really happy that we did that. So these are like the cultural differences that we have to go into, those mental differences coming from that perspective of how they are doing things and how they perceive private property. And another little anecdote, what I think, in this particular area where they were working, 20 of the families worked collectively. Six of the families didn't. And they were able to accommodate that, which is really fascinating in the sense of how capitalism and in this society and socialism and collectivizing and all that. The MST is taking almost all those things and throw them out of the window and build a whole new ones based on Marxist Leninism, capitalism, whatever you want to call them. But they build new realities accommodating what they need to do individually. So in that particular space, there were 20 families that worked collectively, 6 families who didn't. And they managed somehow. I was baffled. I couldn't understand how they managed to have 6 families who did not belong to the cooperative and still work on the same piece of land. And yet they did. They have a central pantry where they all bought food and for everybody, things that they didn't produce. Let's say they didn't produce sugar, so they bought sugar or rice. Actually, they produce rice. Sugar and flour is the 2 things I can think of. And I ask, how you know who takes what from the main pantry? And they say they take what they need. And I say, what if they take too much? And the question was, why will they take too much? It makes no sense. Yeah, no. And then I ask, so how do you coordinate the working hours? And he says, everybody works. And I ask, but how you know somebody's not pulling their weight and slacking a little? It's like, they go, well, you see them slacking and you tell them to work a little more. And so there was no, I don't know, time track of all these things in this particular area. In other areas, I saw they had to maintain a strict time. And so that's how they accommodated all these different realities. And that's where my mind went into this spinning motion that I couldn't understand. You know, I had to readapt to these realities and how things change. And how that's how they managed to work this hybrid of socialism, whatever you want to call it, collectivism, inside a capitalistic system. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. They had experiments sometimes that don't work as good, but they have tremendous success and they are taking a chance, which is more than I can say about a lot of other places and people.
I was just going to add that, I mean, the MST is also really clear that what they're struggling for is socialism. That's the goal. So, and the question about the class, you know, debate between South America and Latin America and the United States, I mean, obviously, it's so much more developed there. This, the idea of class and this issue is huge and important, and all of these movements understand it deeply. Whereas in the United States, obviously, that's just not the case for a lot of people. The question about discipline in the United States, there have been many movements that have had a deep discipline, ethic, civil rights. But obviously that's not the Occupy movement, right? And real quick about the MST, in 2009 they celebrated their 25th anniversary, and they stated, it was very clear that their fight was not just against the latifundio, but it was against the big agribusiness and against neoliberalism in general, and that what they wanted to do was to join with movements, urban movements, and whatever else. So it was very clear, even at the 25th anniversary, that was kind of like the next step, was to really unite with these different movements around in the city.
I'm sorry, yeah. And I must add, and they are also really willing to send people to work and help. There's something Michael already pointed out. They have sent people to, for example, Haiti after the earthquake. Before the earthquake, they had something like 15 people working in Haiti doing land work and agrarian reform work there with people in Haiti. After the earthquake, they actually sent 60 people extra to Haiti. So they really are into this, like, we are gonna show you how this is done, and we're gonna work with you, we're gonna learn from you, and you're gonna learn from us. And that's something that is really important. They love people visiting, so.
Wow. The question about the political parties and political power, I think first off, it's really hard to generalize, especially over Latin America. Obviously, there are some movements. I have not been in Latin America since Occupy started, so I can't speak directly to, you know, Occupy Sao Paulo or Occupy Rio or whatnot. But obviously, there are some movements in which you find that, and the political parties and the political power has a huge sway. And then there are other areas where you can feel, you walk in and you can tell that this is, you know, grassroots, And this is something where people are focused, especially with the MST and other kind of collective movements, including, say, in Venezuela with the CTU, with the urban land committees. And you could tell it's not just positioning for power and political structures, whatever else. The question about, so is it possible to unite everyone behind an Occupy movement? I don't know.
Right. Why don't I answer this? It's unavoidable. It's unavoidable. That's where we're heading. Unavoidable. It's going to happen. Whether we, as individuals, like it or not, that's where we're heading. And the more people see how things are happening, I mean, it is incredible. Countries in Latin America where there's been so much repression and so much, I mean, Brazil had a horrible dictatorship. Argentina had a horrible dictatorship. Chile had a horrible dictatorship. So did Venezuela. I mean, every single country. I mean, supposedly Colombia is the oldest democracy, you know, in Latin America. And we had a benevolent dictatorship. Rojas Pinilla was a good, wonderful man who took over power and stopped the La Violencia. But, you know, and it's still a country run by paramilitaries and whatnot. It is unavoidable. It is unavoidable that we're going to start working with each other and seeing each other. It's a question of now in the United States, which is the exciting thing about the Occupy movement, there is an awakening of seeing that it can happen, you know. I mean, and people know extensively in Latin America about U.S. history, for example. People know about the Black Panthers. They know about Martin Luther King. They know about all these things, and is almost like a wake-up call that they are seeing the Occupy movement and they get inspired by it, even though they have been struggling for so long and fighting for so many things and occupying, even though they're not calling it occupying in so many places. But it's almost a wake-up call that this is going to be a multiple-way thing going back and forth of people talking to each other. It's unavoidable. It's coming.
It was really deep. I had a conversation, which we published in the last NACLA, with a gentleman from the University of Puerto Rico who had been kind of helping to lead many of the student strikes, and also someone from, he's actually one of the leaders of the student Mapuche movement and really involved in like the student strikes in Chile. And it was a conference call over Skype a couple of months ago. And it was just really profound to hear them, you know, back and forth talking about their own movements, the differences between the countries in support of each other. And then you had, and I'm talking not just about national unity, but also going bigger. I believe it was in December or late November, you had five or six different Latin American countries, Brazil, Colombia, Chile, and a few other ones that actually united on one day of action for the students in all these different countries. And they, you know, either shut down their universities or led very large strikes and whatnot. So it's really this type of organizing, this type of unity is really profound. And like you said, people, it's happening. It is happening. I think your question about Brazil, what does that mean? Brazil is growing. Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Obviously, Brazilian growth, it's been really important the way that Brazil has stood up to the United States over the last, say, decade, whether it's supporting Manuel Zelaya in Honduras and allowing him to stay in the consulate, in the embassy in Tegucigalpa, or whether it's, you know, demanding that the Cuba be allowed back, or the U.S., you know, lift its embargo on Cuba and whatnot. At the same time, yeah, you have these issues where, at the same time as this growth has ensured that Lula has been able to lift 20 million people out of poverty and Dilma's, you know, continuing with those social programs and things like that, they're not transformative social programs. They're not even social programs where people are uniting, like in Venezuela, where you have communal councils and whatnot, and people decide where they want. It's just families that are receiving money because they have kids in schools and other kind of welfare programs. Has it supported? Yes. Is it different than what has been in the past? Yes. Is it better than what a lot of other presidents have had? Absolutely. Is it the end all to be all? No. A lot of folks on the left in Brazil are absolutely fed up, especially with the step and the support for agribusiness. It's absolutely insane. So these are the massive contradictions, especially in a country like Brazil, which traditionally has always kind of seen itself as kind of the sub-hegemon to the United States, as kind of the U.S.'s lesser partner in Latin America. And that's the role of the corporations still to this day, Brazilian corporations. That's how other countries see the Brazilian economy. So these are all contradictions and conflicts which play out, and that's the reality, you know, of Brazil especially.
I want to thank all of our panelists, and just to have a brief concluding remarks, but Anna Manzo, who's part of our Between the Lines program in the red shirt there, and Richard Hill helped put this together today, so I want to thank them. But I think we owe our panelists a real debt of gratitude for all the information and analysis they brought us today on two different movements, but certainly ones that complement each other and can learn a lot from each other. And I want to thank them again. Please. By the way, Anna's got our Between the Lines cards in case you want to